Shrink Wrap Radio number 301, The Hero's Journey and Dreams, with Kelly Sullivan Walden.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Kelly Sullivan Walden, author, dream worker, and hypnotherapist, and we'll be discussing Joseph Campbell's model of the hero's journey as it applies to dreams. According to her website, dream therapist Kelly Sullivan Walden is a certified clinical hypnotherapist and the author of the number one Amazon.com best-selling dream book, I Had the Strangest Dream, The Dreamer's Dictionary for the 21st Century, as well as Discover Your Inner Goddess Queen, An Inspirational Journey from Drama Queen to Goddess Queen, and Zone Golf. Kelly is the host of The D-Spot, a weekly web radio show on the Awakening Zone, where she explores the nexus of nighttime dreams, daytime desires, and destiny. Kelly is featured regularly on Fox, NBC, CBS, and ABC News and magazines such as Cosmopolitan, Elle, Bride, 17, Woman's World, and U.S. Weekly. She goes on to say you can read her weekly dream blog on AOL's MyDaily.com. Kelly is the creator slash founder of The Dream Project, a nonprofit organization that bridges inspired young people to solve the issues facing the United Nations and the Millennium Development Goals. Now, here's the interview. Kelly Sullivan Walden, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to have this opportunity to meet you here because you're going to be a presenter at the upcoming 29th Annual International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference. That's a mouthful.
I know. Very good. I'm impressed. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah, as I was looking through the huge set of offerings over the 4.5 days, I was particularly drawn to your workshop on the hero's journey as it relates to dreams. Mm. And so I'm really looking forward to that. But before we get into that, I'd like to get more on your background because I've been on your website. I've listened to your interview podcast. I've watched one of your dream drama sessions on YouTube. And it all left me wondering if you have a background in theater.
Oh, that's so funny. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that. So bravo to you. Yeah, I actually, when throughout my 20s, I was acting. I was in some movies and some television shows like ER and Star Trek. And,
oh, wow. Chalk one up for my intuition. Yeah,
I know. I'm so impressed. It seems like a thousand lifetimes ago. But yeah, I do have a sort of a theatrical background. I did a little bit of theater, mostly in high school, but more film and television throughout my 20s.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, just because you come across, you know, I figured either theater or college major in communications or something like that, because you come across so polished.
And, thank you.
Both beautiful, if I may say so, and polished.
So. Well, I just love you, David. You sure know how to get a girl smiling.
good.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought that acting was the only thing I could ever find a passion for, because it felt like the opportunity to never have a dull moment, the opportunity to explore so many different aspects of mm-hmm. life, and the opportunity to feel so many different things. And then one day while I was pursuing acting, I kind of overlapped and developed I was taking classes in hypnotherapy, and I started seeing clients, and I had an aha moment while I was in the midst of a session that everything that I loved about, that I thought was so alive about making films and being in the theatrical world, was all the juice was present in a session. I was on the edge of my seat. It was intuitive. There was a magic that was present, and I realized it's possible to have an exciting, deep, juicy, magical life that doesn't have to, and I don't have to wait for somebody to yell action or wait for the phone to call and be kind of the actress damsel in distress that was always, you know, kind of a victim in a sense, waiting for somebody to give me the cue when to begin. And I realized, wow, I can have this juicy life and explore different realities with people, and I can call the shots.
Yeah, boy, I can really relate to that. Actually, there's some similarities with my own path. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, do you have a background in marketing? Because having been on your website, it's clear that you're very entrepreneurial, and it doesn't come across as a beginner's effort.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, when my book, I had the strangest dream, The Dreamer's Dictionary for the 21st Century, when that book came out, there's so much. I mean, it was kind of the strangest thing was I had given up acting years before because it just felt like it was the dark ages. It felt like it wasn't going to work. In fact, I had so many dreams that told me, Kelly, you're done. You're done. Stop mm-hmm. it. Like, switch gears. And then so I said, okay, I'm letting that past go. And I fully went 100% into doing therapy, hypnosis, and hypnotherapy with people. Really a much more insular kind of a world, but really satisfying to me. But then this book comes out, and all of a sudden, there's all these opportunities to be in the media once again, but this time not as somebody else, but as myself. And soon after the book came out, I met somebody named Steve Allen, not the deceased comedian, but a guy who was a publicist who became a dear friend of mine and my husband, and he actually kind of took me under his wing, and he was kind of the one that put Doreen Virtue on the map and said, honey, I'm going to make you a star, but kind of in this area. He really, so he's helped me, he's really gotten me in front of a lot of media just because he's been inspired, and he's since become a really dear friend. So, I mean, I didn't have a marketing background myself, per se, but I kind of have learned as I've gone along and done, like, probably over 500 interviews at this point.
Oh, my goodness.
So sometimes if you give something up, it comes back if it's meant to be yours. It doesn't if it wasn't.
Yes. Now, you mentioned hypnotherapy. What was it that drew you in that direction?
Well, I was always the Dear Abby type growing up. I was always the person that I would hear people tell me, wow, I've never told anybody that before.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I prided myself on that. I loved, my mother was that kind of person. As a little girl, I would see my mom sitting at the kitchen table with strangers, with neighbors, with people coming over, crying in her lap and her soothing them and giving them advice. And I looked up to her. I looked up to her ability to do that, and I kind of emulated that and became a mini-me version of her growing up. So I thought that I, at some point, that I would want to be a therapist. I took psychology classes, and I was studying to become a psychotherapist. And somewhere along the lines, I learned about hypnotherapy, and all of a sudden, that felt like, not to put psychotherapy or traditional therapy down in any way, because I think there's tremendous value in it. But it seemed that hypnotherapy and hypnosis was a way of bypassing the morass and the gridlock of the mind and going straight to the issues. And being able to, if you can go straight to a person's issues, you can go straight into offering a solution and see much quicker results. And I'm of the microwave generation, I like results. I like to see people shift in a quick period of time. So hypnosis was really kind of perfect for myself, for my own healing process. And I loved, and I still love, doing sessions with people and seeing the lights turn on and seeing and having them call me within a few days or even a week later and tell me about what profound changes occur as a result of a simple one or two or three hypnosis sessions. It's pretty incredible, dealing straight with the subconscious mind directly. So that's one of the reasons why I loved it so much. And that kind of led me into the realm of dreams.
Okay. And now, do you ever find that as a hypnotherapist that you're in deeper water than you want to be and end up referring somebody out to traditional therapy?
No.
Okay. Well, just something I wondered.
No, I'm sure that anything's possible. Anything could happen. I think that we, I really believe in the law of attraction, and the people that find me are really the people that I'm here to help. And
yeah.
And vice versa. I learn a lot from every session that I do, and from the people that come to me. I feel like we're mirrors of each other. And so I haven't had to, I did refer one person out, because he was a stalker and he wasn't really coming to see me for sessions. He just wanted to be alone with me. And I thought, I'm going to refer you to someone else.
Yeah, really, really.
That just happened.
You mentioned a book earlier, and you've written a number of books, and among them was the one you mentioned, a dream dictionary titled, I Had the Strangest Dream, The Dreamer's Dictionary for the 21st Century. Now, not to be overly provocative here, but most of the dream workers I know try to steer people away from dream dictionaries, feeling that the dream symbols are going to have unique associations and meanings for each individual. So yes. What leads you to fly in the face of that wisdom, which I would assume you've been exposed to?
Oh, absolutely. And as strange as it might sound, I tell people the same thing. And that was my school of thought as well, that, you can't put a blanket label on top of what these associations mm-hmm. mean. And the goal is to empower the individual to find their own sense of meaning for what their dream symbols are telling them.
Yes.
So in the beginning of the book, I make reference to that. It's a pretty big disclaimer, and I say it more often than not, and my husband tells me, Kelly, you got to stop making that disclaimer because enough.
Uh-huh.
But what happened was I didn't know I was going to write a dream book. I was doing my hypnotherapy sessions happily, and as it kind of organically happened, clients would be, after a session or two, people's dreams started to become really vivid, and it seemed that half of the time I would work with people would be spent looking into their dreams. And I, without meaning to, I would start to have intuitive messages, kind of in the way that some people might get intuitive messages when they look at tarot cards. I would start to get a sense of what was really going on with the person based on their dreams. I would start to see things almost like the way a detective does when they see certain clues or triggers. It's like everything starts to become clear. So I would, of course, ask people as many questions as possible to get them to reveal to themselves what their symbols are telling them. But I would often kind of wrap it around and put their words to it, but also give it a little bit of my spin, which tends to be a very life-affirming spin. And I think one thing that really distinguishes my point of view is that I'm a Pollyanna at heart, and not in an airy-fairy way, but I tend to truly believe that the universe is on our side, and that there's no such thing really as a bad dream, that everything, even the most gory, horrific-seeming dream, there's something really positive that could come of it if we work with it and stick with it. So with this point of view, and I would wrap this around my interpretations or my sharing, so many people would tell me, Kelly, you've got to write a book with your point of view about these symbols because there isn't anything out there like this. And there's people, I heard it so many times, and I just started keeping track of some of the main symbols and my point of view of them. And eventually I started to write this book, and it was really organic. And I still say, if what I say in the book doesn't resonate, then toss it out and consider that you're one step closer to what the symbol does mean for you. But often,
how many symbols are in the book?
There's 3,000 symbols.
Okay, wow, that's a lot.
In the PDF, in my unedited, unabridged version, there's 5,000. They told me my publisher said to do 5,000 words, and I did. And then they realized it couldn't fit into a book that was the trade paperback size, so I had to almost cut it in half. Mm-hmm. So I have practically another book in the PDF version.
So in coming up with the meanings, were they all derived sort of internally, intuitively, or did you refer to outside sources as well?
My first pass at the book was all internal. It was my point of view because it's my book. I could write whatever I wanted. So I gave myself permission, and literally I would roll out of bed in the morning, wouldn't even put any water on my face. I would stay sleepy for as long as I could and write for hours. Wow. In that half asleep, half awake state of mind, and write like my first associations with all of the different words. And then when I was done with that process, and I spent a lot of time writing in my bathrobe, not a pretty sight, but when I was done with my first draft, I always think when it comes to writing anything, I like to empower people to not be logical, just be intuitive, get your first draft out as messy as it might be from your gut, from your deepest instinct. And that's what I did. And then afterwards, I polished it. And there were a few people whose work I really learned to admire, and I discovered them as I went along. I love Robert Moss, love Tony Crisp, and Betty Bethards. And I would notice some of their work, and I would notice that there was naturally some similarities, and then there were some things that were new and different and caused me to kind of recreate a few of the symbols. But that was the second draft of it. So the final draft does reference a few different sources, and it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid of all the things that I've learned over the years. I've studied with some shaman. I've done lots of goddess work. I'm a practitioner of religious science, so I've studied most of the major religions, and it's kind of, so my book is really kind of, you see pieces of all of those things in a swirl inside
yes.
the symbol.
Yes, you mentioned Betty Bethards, and there wouldn't be time here now, but at some point down the line, give me a chance to, when we're not on this interview, I'll share a story with you about Betty Bethards and a string of incidents that came to pass in my life as a result of just one brief contact with her. But that's a whole other story.
Okay, well, I would love to hear it.
Yeah.
I would love to, so I'll make a note of that.
Okay. How would you describe your approach to working with dreams individually and in groups if those two are different?
Well, I'm sure there's a thousand ways that they overlap. I think when I'm working with an individual, there's an opportunity to drill deeply inside of a person's dreams and have a history with where they've been and what they're doing. And it's probably very, very related. One thing that we get to do in a group that you can't do with an individual is dream theater. And where you get to reenact a dream in a psychodrama kind of a way, mm-hmm. but where each person gets to play a significant aspect of the dream, and then you get to recreate it until the dreamer has a tremendous aha and feels 10 feet tall and elated. And so that's something that's an opportunity to get to do in a group that you don't get to do individually. Also, I love in a group environment, one metaphor that I use is that I believe dreams are like a diamond. Each dream is a diamond. And when a dream is being discussed, it's like we're placing the diamond in the center of the circle. And based on the position of where each person sits, you are able to perceive a different facet of the dream than the person sitting across the room from you or next to you.
Wow, I thought I was the one who came up with the diamond metaphor. Maybe I got it somewhere else, and I use it just slightly differently. I like the way that you did it as each person representing a facet, and the way that I've used it in my teaching is to talk about if you hold the dream up to different theories,
you see
something different, and they're all true.
Yes. Very true. And I love the fact, this is great, I love that we have this in common, that a dream is a diamond in our world, in our collective consciousness. We believe that diamonds are so valuable, and dreams are that valuable. They're like big, beautiful diamonds that you don't want to discard just because they don't necessarily make sense or because they're a little rough around the edges. You don't just throw them out.
Oh, I like that part, too. That's going to expand my repertoire. and I'll probably think I invented it.
I love it. Please.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. Yes. I mentioned earlier that I was particularly drawn to the workshop you'll be doing at the upcoming IASD conference because you're correlating Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey with dream work. And the reason I'm so interested is that I've used Campbell's book in a university class that I taught for around 20 years or so, titled Seminar on Myth, Dream, and Symbol. And then I went to a presentation at the 2005 IASD conference by David Gordon. I don't know if you've run across him.
No.
In which he presented on the hero's journey and dreams.
Oh, wow.
In fact, that was my interview with David Gordon was, I interviewed him back in 2005. It was the second podcast interview that I did. Now I'm doing this one with you on the same topic. This is going to be number 301.
Oh, wow.
So this is a long-winded way of saying I'm really interested in this topic and would love to have you lead us through Campbell's stages of the journey and your take on how our dreams might relate to each of those stages.
Oh, wow. Well, I thought I was so original.
Yeah, we keep, right, I know.
This is great, though. I can't wait to listen to that. I hope the podcast is still available.
It is still available, and the audio quality is not terribly good. I was still getting my chops down at that point.
Oh, I don't care. I can't wait to listen to it.
Yeah. He's got a book as well, and the title escapes me, but maybe okay. At the end of the interview, you can go to Amazon and you'll find a book by him, David Gordon.
Sure. So, the question is how does this work in my world, or how do I?
Well, yeah, in terms of Joseph Campbell, and the stages that he talks about, and what that might represent in terms of our dreams.
Well, the first time I heard about the hero's journey. In fact, the first time I was introduced to Joseph Campbell, I was on an airplane and I broke into tears. And there's something about the words that he was using, the quality of it was the power of myth that I was reading. And literally the lady sitting next to me was like, honey, are you okay? She was getting me tissue. And I was like, it's like a dam broke in me. And all I could do was cry. And it wasn't out of sadness. It was out of eureka. I found gold. Oh my God. Everything makes sense. I felt like I was being healed by his words and by his ability to frame our journey and see ourselves as these noble beings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, well, maybe 20 years ago, maybe more, probably more like 25. God, whoa, I have no idea how old I am. Okay, it was over 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And so that was way before I was doing dream work, quote unquote, officially. I was doing my own personal dream work, but not professionally at all. And then, so that planted that seed. And then a couple years ago, I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at a place called Garden of the Goddess. And there's a medicine wheel on the top of a hill that I would often walk up to and do a ceremony on every day. And it was always the case that every time I would go up to this medicine wheel, there would always be an aha waiting for me up there. And I had just finished writing my book, and I was working on my next book, and I was looking, and so dreams were on my mind in a big way. And as I walked up to the medicine wheel and did my ceremony up there, I started getting a download about the hero's journey as it overlapped with dreams, and I saw the whole thing. And so I came down from the medicine wheel that day feeling like I could barely walk. My feet were barely touching the ground. I felt so high because I felt like I'm a synthesizer by nature. I love it when two seemingly disparate systems overlap and come together to create that, like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So these two things that I love so much and love so much felt like they just got bigger and more relevant and more powerful. And it created this kind of, in some ways, what to do with and how to contextualize dreams, as well as the journey of becoming a masterful dreamer or an awakened being.
What a wonderful gift you received.
Yes, yeah, I highly recommend it. If you ever go to Santa Fe, New Mexico, look up Ginny Gentry and Garden of the Goddess and go up to that medicine wheel. I guarantee some beautiful aha will be there waiting for you.
Okay, so back to your story.
Yeah, so I'll walk through the stages, if you'd like, to kind of talk about how I see them weaving together with dreams.
Yes.
Well, the first thing I'll just say as a larger context, and I know this is not news for you and probably for your listeners, but I'll say it as if people don't know what the hero's journey is. 12 stages that map the predictable ups and downs, highs and lows, and journey of somebody who's on a noble quest. And I see the hero's journey, as many others do, as a map of the terrain of our lives as human beings. We're all, just the fact that we were born, that we incarnated here, by virtue of that, we're all heroes on a hero's journey, regardless of what we're doing in this moment that may or may not appear to be heroic. It's a hero's journey just to be alive. So the hero's journey maps our entire life from beginning to end and everything in between. And on a more micro level, in some ways it maps out each day of our lives. And in a larger point of view, it maps out these major cycles that we go through in our lives. And on another level, it maps out each night, each dream. So it's, you can look, just like a diamond, you can look at so many different ways that this manifests. So in general, I say that the first stage is the ordinary world. So in that stage, I like for people in my dream group, for example, to acknowledge the ordinary aspect of preparing themselves to learn about dreams and to become more mindful and masterful as an awakened being and as a masterful dreamer. And the ordinary things that can be done are to set up your ordinary sleep space into a dream sanctuary. By acknowledging your five senses, your sense of sight, making sure that what's in your space where you're going to sleep, making sure that it's orderly, that you don't have mountains of books that are falling over each other on the bedside table, making sure that you don't have piles of laundry all over the place, that you've got your closet doors closed and that there's a sense of order. One of my dear friends is Marie Diamond. She's the a diamond here. That comes up again. Isn't that interesting? She's the feng shui expert that was featured in the movie The Secret. And her and I have spoken at length about our dream zone, our sleep zone, the physical nature of it, having so much to do with the quality of our dreams and the quality of our sleep. And we have so much that we can, there's so many things that we feel powerless about that we can't really do anything about. And then there's the stuff that we can absolutely do something about. So clearing the decks, making sure that your sense of sight, that what you do see around you is affirming, that you don't have images of water in your sleep zone, because the subconscious mind can't discern between what is actually there and what is imagined. And she says if you have water in your sleep, most people will have dreams of drowning or of being overwhelmed. If you have images of huge, game like lions or tigers or bears that your subconscious mind might feel like you're being threatened while you're asleep. So there's different points of view on that, but basically making sure that your sense of smell, that there's some kind of, lovely aromatherapy in the room. There's been research that was done in Mannheim, Germany a couple years ago about sweet smells elicit sweet dreams, foul smells elicit foul dreams. So we can control to some degree what we smell in our sleep state, what we taste, make sure that you've got some kind of mouthwash before you go to sleep, that you don't drink fruit juice. So these are all ordinary things that relate to the ordinary world stage of the hero's journey, and that includes putting your dream journal right by the bed, so that ordinary thing is right there that you can get when you wake up, or a recorder, the however you record your dreams.
So right, so in Campbell's template, the hero is in the ordinary world, and then something unusual happens that he characterizes as the call to adventure. So tell us about that.
So the call to adventure is when we get sleepy, when we fall asleep. We're being called in, we're being lured in to sleep. So every time we get drowsy, we're being called. We're being pulled in. Joseph Campbell makes the distinction between the ordinary world and the special world. And when we fall asleep, when we get sleepy, we're being called in to the extraordinary world, or the special world. Mm-hmm. And the stage three is about resistance or refusal to the call. And often, you say in the afternoon, if we start getting drowsy, our knee-jerk reaction is to resist sleepiness. Even like little kids that when it's bedtime, they scream, "No, I don't want to go to sleep!"
Right.
We tend to, most of us in this Western world, we tend to value our awake time, and we completely disown in some ways what happens when we're asleep. It's almost like it's a zero. It means nothing because the awake part of us doesn't recognize that there's anything special going on. It's kind of like dead time. Might as well be dead during that time. And so there's resistance and a refusal to the call often until we're absolutely asleep and we can't fight it anymore. So that's kind of where the resistance, refusal to the call comes in. And if you look at it from another point of view, when it comes to being called to an interesting or magical adventure, usually we'll get excited about the opportunity to learn, to grow, to, and all of that, but there's some part of us, it's like our inner critic or our inner censor that says, "Oh, no, 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 I can't possibly be, I'm not good enough. There's nothing extraordinary happening with me because I'm just an ordinary person." There's an inner fight that we have to even think that we're a hero on a hero's journey.
Or there might be fear, might be an aspect too, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Especially if somebody's been having nightmares, recurring nightmares, I kind of go back and forth between the awake version of the hero's journey and the dream nocturnal version of the hero's journey. But yes, there's resistance all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, because change, we're kind of the survival aspect of ourselves just wants to keep things status quo, whether we like it or not, whether we're fulfilled or not, it doesn't matter. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Keep things the same. Do not rock the boat. So any bit of rocking the boat is met with resistance to some degree. Some of us are more adventurous than others, but there tends to be a lot of resistance to change, to growth, and even to sleep, and even to paying attention to the realm of dreams. So in the hero's journey, there's a mentor. You meet a mentor or a guide, and this being helps you along your journey. So in some ways, as it relates to dreams, I often tell people, especially if they're having any kind of recurring nightmares or issues or any kind of fear of their dreams. And usually for somebody like me who's a dream therapist, most of the people that seek me out are not the ones that are having the happiest dreams in the world. They tend to be the people that are having issues or having dreams that are upsetting to them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, most of the people that are having flying dreams all the time kind of keep those to themselves.
They don't need help.
No. I mean, sometimes I'll hear about them, but most of the time it's the scary dreams that find me first.
Yeah. So does the mentor, the guide that you're talking about, does this need to be like a figure that appears that is explicitly saying, "I am here to guide you," or does it manifest in subtler ways?
It's all of the above. So sometimes I tell people if they don't automatically. Some people have a dream guide that they connect with regularly. I just was interviewing my dear friend Kathy Canavis, who has a recurring dream guide that comes to her in her dreams, and he's always wearing like a Franciscan monk outfit. Mm. She was raised Christian, so she wasn't raised Catholic and has had no association with Franciscan monks. But yet this Franciscan monk appears, and every time he appears, she knows that something extraordinary is about to happen. So some people have the gift of having a recurring character that shows up that they know for sure is a trusted guide. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has that. But if you don't already have that kind of being, you can, I tell people sometimes to just think about somebody in their waking, with their waking mind in a meditation before going to sleep, of somebody that they would like to be their guide. It could be Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, some Muhammad, their grandmother, their pet, somebody that gives them a sense of strength and wisdom and a sense of, I've got your back. And I have them meditate on that person or on several people. I create a like a Knight of the Round Table, mm-hmm. kind of a round table that has these higher beings that, you know, when you think of them, you sort of entrain to them, and it connects you with that level of seeing and being.
Fascinating. These would be your allies.
Those would be your allies. There's a bit of a distinction between the allies and the mentor.
Okay.
Even though there's a place where they overlap for sure. The mentor, to me, is clearly somebody that is higher and wiser than you. I think that from the Carl Jung perspective, it's all within us. So even if I think of the Dalai Lama, there's that part of me that is connected to him. But in my human, ordinary waking state, I put him above me.
Mm-hmm.
Like way, way, way above me. So I would think of him as a mentor. So that's kind of that's the way I play with that. But the Dalai Lama could also be an ally as well. But the mentors, I put them in sort of a special category where these are beings that seem to be way, way, way higher than the thoughts that you could possibly conceive of for yourself.
I like the way you just said, that's the way that I play with that.
Yes.
Which suggests a kind of playful attitude, a willingness to try things on, to be experimental, and to not take it too seriously.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's a place where I'm sure I get really serious and attached, but I try to remember, keep it loose and keep in the flow with it, because things, you know, one day something might seem so solid, and then 2 days later it starts to get flimsy and it falls apart and something else takes its place.
Mm-hmm.
So for now, as much as I wholeheartedly believe this, I'm always open for there being, I guess I'm an opportunist at heart. I'm always looking for the next best thing that really resonates. And this has resonated for quite a while, so whatever does replace this model will have to be phenomenal.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Let's keep this moving, because I know you have an appointment coming up.
Yeah.
So now
yeah.
we come to the stage called Crossing the Threshold. Tell us about yeah. that.
Well, one point of view about crossing the threshold is that there's a threshold guardian, and there's always a riddle that you can't cross the threshold into the special world unless you solve the riddle. One point of view is that our dreams are riddles. Our dreams mm-hmm. are wordplay. And I get the chills as I'm saying this, because I feel like like we can talk about a dream. Somebody can come to me and say, I had the strangest dream. What does this mean? Somebody news, and then they're, oh, actually my husband shared a dream with me this morning. I was in a pen with a bull, and he pinned me down, and I started singing to him, and this goat came over, and then it turns out that these two are in love, and it's so weird. What does that mean? So from the ordinary mind's perspective, it's nonsensical. It's completely ridiculous. I've heard the word ridiculous used so often to describe people's dreams, when they're describing their own dreams. But when you take the time to break down the symbols and to really get to familiar with what it means to you, and you have that aha, you cross the threshold. You have been permitted into the special world where you're out of the ordinary, linear, mundane experience of life, and you're all of a sudden catapulted into a realm where everything becomes magical, where everything takes on a sparkle to it, and where all of a sudden things that seem difficult or hard or out of reach all of a sudden magically feel like you're connected to it all. So crossing the threshold is, to me, the dream itself is that riddle that gives you access into the special world of what we're capable of being.
Wonderful.
Then we've got the belly of the whale. And in the belly of the whale, I look at those, I look at dreams that are belly of the whale-esque as dark night of the soul.
Yes. Dream.
And that can mean, you know, and also any dreams that relate to water. Water is such a big symbol. So many people have dreams that take place somewhere in water. There's something happening with water, whether it be a positive, like an enjoyable dream, or a dream that's a nightmare or overwhelming them. So I put water dreams in the belly of the whale category, as well as dreams that represent, in some ways, even though we get to the ordeal stage later, in some ways the belly of the whale is everything that we're most afraid of. We're either afraid of being cast out and being all alone, or we're afraid on the other side of the scale of being overwhelmed and taken over by something. The belly of the whale, to me, represents both of those extreme fears that we humans have. Mm-hmm. And those two fears manifest in our dreams as either being chased by something, or cornered by something, or enveloped by something, or being completely disowned, having people turn their backs on you and not talk to you or cut you off.
Wow. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. And so in embracing those dreams and holding those really scary dreams in the context of that's the belly of the whale stage, then to me it gives it a nobler context. It's like, oh, it's part of the journey. It's important to come to terms with both of those extremes.
Yes.
So we get spit out of the belly of the whale, and then we're connecting with the tests, allies, and enemies, which you expressed a moment before. And in this stage, this is kind of the typical dream. The average, ordinary dream tends to be about tests, allies, and enemies. We're either, mostly our dreams in some way, shape, or form are testing us. We're having to scale a wall. We're having to figure out how to get past something. Or often are not, I wouldn't call them nightmares per se, but just even just the annoying, low-level, difficult dreams would be put into the test and enemy category. I like to say that the enemies are the allies in disguise, whether in our waking life or in our dreams, our nighttime dreams, because they're always prompting us to, they're always testing our mettle. They're always making us have to reveal a resource that we didn't know we had.
I love that. The enemies are our allies in disguise. That's great.
It's helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to remind myself of that sometimes when I'm going through a difficult stage in my life. Like,
sure.
Okay, these people are allies in disguise. They're helping me learn a new resource that I have, but I don't know I have.
Mm-hmm.
Some new part of myself is going to be revealed because of this person and the way they're testing me. So often in this stage, one really strong recurring dream theme that I hear so often are dreams about being in school.
Oh, yes. I've had plenty of those.
Yes. So those dreams show up in this category. Where you're literally being tested, you're having to take an exam, you're being examined, you're having to look at these points of view that you've developed that came from your school age days, where you're, you know, perhaps the first time you were ever tested or the first time you ever fell in love, the first cut is the deepest. And often the first cut for most of us, some of them, it came from our mom and dads, but a lot of the typical cuts that we deal with came from school days, either elementary or junior high or high school, when we we were finding our sense of self and being cut and tested.
That's an interesting point. I've not heard that point articulated that way before, and it brings to mind all the attention right now on bullying, which so many of us experienced at some point.
Oh my God. Yeah, I was the victim of unbelievable bullying. My life was threatened on almost a regular basis, and this is before text messaging.
Yeah.
I'm grateful I grew up when I did. I can't imagine that coming into my cell phone on a regular basis. Oh. I would have notes in the locker from girls saying, "We're going to kill you. We're going to beat you up."
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so I know I've had more than my share of school dreams that relate to.
I'll bet.
And many of us do. It's one of the more common dreams that I hear about.
Now, the next step you've called ordeal, and how does that differ from tests, allies, and enemies? That all sounds kind of like an ordeal.
Yes, as well as the belly of the whale. So there's overlapping places, but
sure.
The way I distinguish the ordeal is. I like to think of the movie Star Wars where Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker are having their big showdown, and Luke Skywalker realizes that his big enemy is his father. I wouldn't say it's the most common theme, but it's often enough that I'll have people share with me their most gruesome, and this I just put on the scale of like the hierarchy of gruesome dreams. These are the most gruesome dreams. These are frightmares. These are dreams that truly traumatize people if they're left untended to. And I had one recently myself, actually, and I have the most, and it related to my father, actually, so I'll just reveal a little piece of myself here.
Sure.
I have a great relationship in real life with my father. I love him. My dad was a police chief, really strong alpha male type who was very dominating, and I was scared of him growing up, but I've since just grown to absolutely love him. But in my dream not that long ago, I was trying to kill him in a thousand different ways as he was trying to kill me. And in my dream, I finally ripped up the carpet, dug a hole, had him walk in. I tricked him, made him fall in the hole, fastened the carpet, put furniture on top of it, and he was buried, and I knew I had overcome him.
Boy, you're really creative in your dreams.
You got to do what you got to do. So I was traumatized by this dream, and then I realized, wait a second, this is an ordeal dream. And I had just had a client a couple weeks before that dreamt that she ate her father. And if that happened in real life, obviously she'd be arrested and put into a cell next to Hannibal Lecter. But in the dream, it's actually such an amazing thing to dream that you're overcoming your father. You're overcoming the patriarchy. You're overcoming the glass ceiling that's been put over, and we all have some form of a glass ceiling. We're busting out of these belief systems that have kept us locked in, and something is breaking through, and it tends to be gory. It tends to be dramatic with a capital D. So it doesn't have to just be literally a dream that relates to your father, but it can be dealing with. Here's another one where somebody was dreaming about King Kong. It was a man that I know, a TV producer who's so strong, powerful, and he has this recurring dream that King Kong is coming to stomp on him. And I had him reconnect with the dream, have him eventually find that King Kong was an aspect of himself and his own ally, and King Kong put him on his shoulder, and he got to ride on King Kong's shoulder and have a view of the world that was so much higher than he had, and he got to feel more powerful in the places where he had been feeling weak. So when you work with these ordeal dreams, these are perfect for dream theater or dream alchemy. That's when the most beautiful transformation, life-changing transformation, can really, really happen.
Okay, well, we need to keep moving right along. And so now we come to the reward.
Yes. So the reward is kind of what I was just saying. It yeah. really comes from having dealt with it. If you, like many other people say, I believe that a nightmare is an unfinished dream. When you finish the dream, whether in your nocturnal dreaming state or when you wake up and do a meditation that puts you back in the dream and has you redirect it as a lucid dreamer in your dream, even though you're slightly awake, you bring the dream to a place of fulfillment like the guy did with his King Kong dream.
Oh, yeah, that's a perfect illustration of it had to feel so rewarding to experience himself upon King Kong's shoulders.
He had been having this dream since he was a kid, and uh-huh. that he was in his late 40s, probably early 50s. So that's a long time to be tortured by a dream like that. And yes. it was done once and for all. So he not only was able to stop having the fear of having this recurring dream or even having the recurring dream, but he was able to get this infusion of power that nothing in his waking world could have ever given him. No amount of money, no reassurance from his wife, nothing could give him what his dream was able to give him once he worked with it. So that's the gift. That's really the gift. It's an internal gift that eventually yields to, it can't help but yield to external evidence that what happens within us has to affect our outer world and vice versa. So there's always something really, really, for all this work that a person's done, there's something sweet on the other side of it. And I believe, and just I was telling somebody a couple days ago who had a dream of this dream lover that gave her the most delicious kisses, and nobody in real life has ever kissed her this way. Mm-hmm. And I told her, do not leave that dream on the pillow. That is a dream that you should carry with you everywhere you go. Do not waste your time being disappointed that it was quote-unquote only a dream. This is the kind of dream that you want to integrate and infuse into your body of affairs. Carry it with you like a meditation. I'll tell you one thing really quick because it ties into the next stage. There was, are you okay with me just rambling here?
No, you're not rambling. This is all very relevant. And the instruction for her to carry it with her sounds like it does tie into the next stage of the journey
yes.
back.
Yes, exactly. So you're integrating it into your real life. Mm-hmm. You're not leaving the dream in the dream world. It really must become a part of our waking world. So here's an even better example than that. A woman named Diane who sent me a random dream question about a year ago. And she said that she didn't tell me anything about herself. She just told me about this very pleasurable dream where she was floating in billowing clouds of, it felt like fabric, and it felt like she was receiving the most amazing hug from the universe. And while she was floating in this energy, she heard the words, smile, smile big, smile wow. as big as you can. So wow. she woke up from that dream with the biggest smile on her face that she wasn't able to take off all day. And
wonderful.
She felt so good. And she sent me the dream. And really, my response was, this dream requires no, we don't have to decipher this dream mm-hmm. and interpret it. Really, this is a dream for meditation. This is a dream to carry with you into your waking life. So here's your prescription, as if it was medicine. Focus on this dream and the way that it made you feel for 5 minutes a day. And see what opens up for you and see what that brings about. Literally, 6 months later, I get a message from her, an email saying, this is Diane. I don't know if you remember me. I'm the smile big lady. Sent me that. How could I forget? I've never heard a dream like that before. What I didn't tell you was that at the time that I had this dream, I had nothing to smile about in my life. I had just been diagnosed with brain cancer, terminal brain cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
My life was absolutely in shambles. The relationship I was in had just disintegrated. Everything was wrong in my life in the worst way. And I did nothing different, but I did what you said. She said, my life for the next 6 months was the way it normally had been. But I focused on that feeling tone for 5 minutes a day. And she said, and I am happy to tell you that I just got a clean bill of health from my doctor. They don't know how, they don't know what, but the cancer is gone.
Wow. Does that tie in to the next stage? We've got two stages, resurrection and return with elixir, and that sounds like maybe it's got all of that in there.
So there is exactly. So the resurrection is actually where you're on the road back and you start coming back into the waking world. And this is where the caterpillar becomes the butterfly. This is exactly, and I'm covered in chills once again talking to you, David. But this woman, Diane, actually did that. She took the dream that was, let's call it a caterpillar. It connected her with her in a special way, but she activated it. She brought it into her waking life by meditating on it every day for just a few minutes, and it changed her. She became a different person. She became a different version of herself. Or we could say she was able to drop all the stuff that wasn't her, and she became the true being that she was underneath it all along. So that's what happens in the resurrection. That we wake up. There's an altering of perception of who we are.
And the return with the elixir, does that involve somehow sharing that gift with others?
You're so intuitive, David. Yes, exactly. This is many, many dream tribes believe that a dream isn't just the property of the dreamer. That the dream comes for the benefit of the dreamer, but it's for the benefit and upliftment and edification and enlightenment of the tribe. So especially these kind of dreams, they must be shared. They come with a great responsibility that, I mean, sure, you can keep it to yourself if you want, but they're medicinal. Everybody that I know that's heard that Diane dream, they take a deep breath and there's something that transmits beyond just Diane. I mean, I feel it. I think about it on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And there's other dreams that were not my dreams, but somebody else's dream that they shared with me. Even my husband sharing with me about the bull singing a song to this lamb. It's like, oh, there's something that touches my soul about that. And it benefits me, and it benefits everyone who has the ears to hear the dream is uplifted. And the goal is to have, you know, the idea of as one is lifted, all are lifted. But it helps if you share it, if you share that elixir, that medicinal story, that alchemical experience, so that we can exponentially grow from glory to greater glory.
And yeah. Well, Kelly, you've been so generous in sharing this all with us. Do I understand that you're working on a book about this very thing?
I have a curriculum, a home study course that is just now. It's on my website. So I wouldn't call it a book so much as a curriculum. It's what I'm basing the dream workshops that I'm teaching now on, and this home study course. The new book that I'm writing incorporates some of this philosophy, but it's called, and I just got a book deal actually with Red Wheel Wiser, so it'll be coming out this time next year, called It's All in Your Dreams, 5 Portals to an Awakened Life. And maybe that's something we can talk about on another show.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. And I will put a link to your website in our show notes. And I know that you do have to run along. So Kelly Sullivan Walden, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
David Van Nuys, you are amazing. I really appreciate your space, your listening. And I feel like you and I just went around the medicine wheel together. We went around the hero's journey together. Your listening just helps to make it this process that much more magical. I love what you're doing. And I've listened to several of the podcasts, and they're all so, so juicy. I hope I get to meet you at the Dream Conference, at the IASD conference this June. Will you be there?
Likewise, and we will meet, and I imagine I'll be in your workshop. So
we'll have
a chance to meet there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you. Well, we had a nice mutual admiration society going there. I think Kelly and I had great rapport, and I hope you felt you were in on that as well. Admittedly, I'm a bit more straight-laced than Kelly, given my academic training and background. I think it's apparent that she's much more open to a wide variety of New Age ideas than I am, not only because of my academic background, but probably also due to my own personality. At the same time, I have to say I envy her optimism and overall positivity, and it's clear to me that she is indeed very intuitive, and I don't doubt that she's quite effective with the people she works with. I think her confidence and expansiveness is quite contagious, and when it comes to healing and inspiring self-healing, that's a good thing. She's also clearly a thinker and has brought together her own unique synthesis from a variety of sources. I love what she's done with Campbell's model. I recently drew up my own outline correlating the stages of the hero's journey with the dream process. I'm definitely going to want to expand my outline to include some of Kelly's insights. It's not altogether different from what I had, but there are points of difference that I think are quite intriguing that I'd like to include. I need to listen back to the interview to pick up on some of the key ideas that caught my interest, or maybe someone will step forward to transcribe this episode, which personally I'd find very useful. If we had had more time, I would have shared a dream I had this morning. I would have loved to get her take on it, but I knew she had an appointment scheduled at the top of the hour, and so I needed to be mindful of the clock. I'm looking forward to participating in her workshop at the upcoming Dream Conference in June, because if nothing else, it's clear to me that I'll walk away with fresh inspiration. After our interview was over, she invited me to be an interview guest on her podcast, and we picked a date in May. I'm sure we'll have lots of fun sharing in our next encounter, and I look forward to it. Maybe I'll share that story that I didn't have time to get into in this interview. I'll be sure to tell you when that's up, in case you wish to check it out.
Did you know that Shrink Wrap Radio is now 7 years old? Did you know that between Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel Podcast, that Dr. Dave has conducted over 400 interviews? Did you know that for your convenience, most interviews also have a transcript available? But wait, there's more. If you'd like to listen to the show on the move, now there's an app for that. All the details and purchase links for the Shrink Wrap Radio app are posted on the website.
Thanks for that promo, Mike West. And let me hasten to thank all of you who've made donations. I especially want to acknowledge our new ultra-colossal donor, Ashley Taggart, a marriage and family therapist with a practice in Palo Alto, California, who joins our other ultra-colossal donor, John Holmston, in the Bahamas, and our two super-colossal donors, Katie Morrison in Melbourne and Peter Myron in Chicago. You folks have set the bar high, and I thank you. I mentioned a while back that I won't be doing any more Wise Counsel podcast interviews. However, there are still 4 of those interviews in the queue. I asked the folks at mentalhelp.net about when those interviews might become available and found out that they will be posted at the rate of 1 a month. My interview with Peter Flom has been up there for some time, so I expect the next one should go up before long. I'll be sure to let you know when it does. Please help us grow our audience by telling your friends and colleagues who you think might benefit from Shrink Wrap Radio. And as you know, I regularly post announcements about our newest episodes and transcripts on Facebook and Twitter, so please retweet when you see those. And speaking of transcripts, there's still no new transcripts to announce this week. So all of those of you who have volunteered to do a transcript, please take this as a reminder to finish up and get them to me or to let me know that you've changed your mind. Finally, let me remind you once again of the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference coming up in Berkeley, California, June 22nd through the 26th, and you can get all the details at www.asdreams.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Reuben Nyman, psychologist, author, and sleep and dream specialist, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, and Dr. Ruben Nyman will be my guest again. More about that in a bit. Now let's listen to a couple of recent comments from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Lisa S., who posted a comment about my interview with Lisa Aspinwall on Shrink Wrap Radio number 298, The Relationship Between Positive Psychology and Health Outcomes. And Lisa S. writes, "Great interview, awesome information. Cleaning up public beliefs through research and studies is truly a contribution to improve public knowledge. A crucial point or notion that concerns many people, basically everybody who sees a doctor and gets a diagnosis, is what medical professionals say and the beliefs this is based on. I was stunned by the research result presented by Dr. Aspinwall that people in a bad mood, and whatever this may include, get subsequently less help. Also, the role of beliefs and belief systems that our thinking collectively and individually is based upon was discussed in a very enlightening way. I think that must be an interesting field for research, or maybe it already is. On a more personal note, I was very sorry to hear about the illness of your son. I hope things are going well for him and the family. Glad to hear that he found what sounded like his vocation. Outstanding interview with an outstanding guest. Thank you very much." And that's from Lisa. And Lisa, thank you so much for posting that comment. And I thought that Lisa Aspinwall was just an incredible guest, very enlightening. And thank you for your concern about my son. He, in fact, is doing really well. It's been 5 years now since that cancer diagnosis, and he seems to be completely recovered, and he's thriving, working very hard to become a nurse practitioner. Moving right along, we heard similarly from Francisco, who posted a comment about number 296, critiquing positive psychology as cancer treatment with James Coyne, PhD. And Francisco observes, "Thought-provoking interview. It might be useful to consider the discourse of positive psychology, particularly its most extreme and questionable assertions, such as you can heal your body through positive thoughts and feelings, in the context of American capitalist ideology. One of the best-known tenets of mainstream American culture is that every person's progress and happiness, and we could include health here, is almost entirely the product of that person's choices and efforts. External factors are not seen as very influential in shaping a person's living conditions. No wonder why the self-help industry has become such a profitable business, catering to people wanting to become rich and healthy, ignoring contextual and hereditary limiting factors." And again, that's from Andrew, and you make some good points there, Andrew. Really appreciate that. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to emails, you can leave comments as the ones that I just read about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Or you can use our iPhone or Android app, which you can find on the apps page on our site. Now, thanks to dream worker Kelly Sullivan Walden for sharing her insights into Campbell's journey of the hero and the dream process. Speaking of dreams, my next episode will feature a return interview with Dr. Ruben Nyman. Dr. Nyman works closely with Dr. Andrew Weil, and we'll be talking about mindful dreaming. We got a lot of very positive feedback the last time Dr. Nyman was on the show, so I know he's going to be a great guest the second time around. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.